Good afternoon and welcome to Weekly Sedition, the show dedicated to dissent and alternative lifestyles. This is Contra, your host, this and every Tuesday at noon, right here on 97.3 WRIR. It's Richmond's independent radio. This is Radio for the Rest of Us. We've got several things to touch on today, the first of which is a matter of much more controversy than I can adequately cover on this particular show, the issue of the death penalty, which has been in the headlines recently because of the challenge in the Supreme Court against lethal injection. This debate centered primarily around whether lethal injection is cruel and unusual punishment. There has been no shortage of discussion on this matter, from the dead serious to the satirical, as we hear in this report from The Onion magazine online.
In Washington today, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a landmark decision. Despite the growing number of death row inmates who've been exonerated due to DNA evidence, the court reaffirmed the legality of the death penalty on the grounds that it is, quote, totally badass. For more on the case, we go live now to Onion News Network Washington correspondent Jane Carmichael. Hi, Jane.
Good to see you, Michael.
How did the Supreme Court come to their decision on this ruling?
Well, Michael, it began this morning when the lawyers for the petitioner presented to the court a videotaped lethal injection that showed an inmate writhing in pain before dying. As the tape played, Justice Kennedy said, quote, whoa. Justice Alito remarked, quote, holy sh**. And Justice Ginsburg said, quote, that's wicked.
And what was the defense counsel's response to that?
Well, following the video, Chief Justice John Roberts said, while evidence presented to the court indicates a degree of fallibility in the procedural methods of capital punishment, it is the opinion of this court that the practice remains hella f***ing balls to the wall awesome. At that point, the decision seemed fairly certain.
Was there any dissent to the opinion by the Chief Justice?
Actually, very little. Justice Clarence Thomas supported the argument immediately, citing the precedent set by the movie 300, in which the offending parties were, quote, kicked into a huge f***ing pit. Justice Samuel Alito then stated, yeah, or like Judge Dredd. Justice Antonin Scalia then stated quite loudly, quote, I am the law.
That's the catchphrase from the film,
yes.
Judge Dredd.
Yes, it is. Then there followed approximately 1 minute of all of the justices individually claiming that they were the law.
Naturally, the issue has been given much more serious discussion in the mainstream news, even jumping U.S. borders, bringing a reporter from the U.K. all the way here to Virginia.
The town of Jarrett is a small interruption in the dense forest of southern Virginia. Its population hovers around 600. Not everyone who makes this trip off the main highway leaves Jarrett alive. It leads to the Greensville Correctional Center, where Virginia executes its condemned.
As the Supreme Court mulled this case over, lethal injections ground virtually to a standstill. The creator of the drug cocktail used for lethal injections denied that the executions were either cruel or unusual, and offered an unusual alternative in the meantime.
If there is any pain, it's a stinging type of sensation that is not the horrific, excruciating pain that has been alleged. The best way to ensure swift executions, and the most surefire, there's nothing wrong with the guillotine. That is absolutely effective. And if people have a problem with drugs, bring back the guillotine.
As The Onion noted, the Supreme Court found that lethal injection did not constitute cruel and unusual punishment, and therefore was not in violation of the Fourth Amendment, as long as the right person did the deed.
In an operating room, that is performed by a skilled, trained doctor who watches the level of anesthetic, who watches the patient to make sure they are still under that drug. No one disputes the fact that the next two drugs can be very painful if you're not under an anesthetic.
Accordingly, Virginia executed its 102nd person this past week in the very facility mentioned by that British report a moment ago. Christopher Emmett was put to death Thursday for bludgeoning a man to death with a lamp for money to feed his drug addiction. There were a number of Richmond citizens who view not only Emmett's execution, but all executions as injustices, and let our community know that by staging an action at the corner of Broad and 11th Street. Activists lined the sidewalk there, holding anti-death penalty messages for the traffic to see. I was able to catch up with Betty Gallagher at the demonstration, a board member of Virginians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
This is an organization that was started by a man named Harry Heller, who was determined to end the death penalty, and he thought it was possible that if he offered juries the alternative of life in prison without parole, that a lot of them would rather give that sentence to someone rather than the death penalty.
Betty says Heller's plan worked, and that since its inception, the demand for the death penalty in Virginia has gradually decreased. As it turns out, juries and judges feel more comfortable sentencing people to life in prison for at least a couple of reasons.
Then they don't have to worry about sentencing someone who might be innocent to death, and they also don't have to worry about letting a dangerous criminal out on the streets if they think he's worthy of the death penalty, but they're really not sure. It's kind of almost a safer position to be. And then if somebody is innocent, you know, there's time for them for evidence maybe to surface.
As it turns out, inmates who aren't guilty need time to prove their innocence, and a lot of it.
The average time for someone be able to prove that they're innocent when it can be shown is about 9 years, whereas the average time on death row is like 6 or 7 years. And so we frequently execute people before there's a chance for them to show that they're innocent. One exception so far is Earl Washington, who was shown to be innocent within days, I think it was 9 days of his execution. And they say, well, that just shows the system works. Well, it didn't. It was a fellow person on death row, Joe Giantarno, who is actually on our board. He was the one who realized that Earl Washington was innocent. And so he was the one who pushed and pushed until he got it proved.
So this was actually someone on death row who pushed to get someone off of death row,
yeah.
And it actually succeeded within 9 days of his sentence?
Yeah, so that was fairly dramatic. Now, of course, many of the people on death row are guilty, but it's just that I think there's a higher incidence of mistakes with murders because the police are under pressure to solve the crime. There do seem to be a lot of people who have been shown to be innocent. The last number I remember is 123 nationwide, but I think that's enough to give a lot of people pause and start to worry about giving somebody, you know, the death penalty when they could give them the equivalent of the death penalty, which is life without parole, and society is still protected.
Some Richmonders traveled to Emmett's execution site in Jarrett for a vigil outside that facility. The issue is complicated, and we have to realize the plain fact that there are very real human impulses to revenge. If someone were to kill a member of my family or my friend or my partner, I don't have any doubt that I would want to kill that person. Is it justice to murder the murderer, or is it just revenge? Is revenge an adequate reason to do so? These are issues that are way too big to cover satisfactorily on a half-hour show. But I think they're issues that we should all think about, that we should devote some consideration to. And if you decide that the death penalty is wrong, probably even some activism to. Because no matter how much you do or don't think about it, it is an issue that's affecting people's lives, ending people's lives. For Virginians, we're at 102 and counting. I'd like to share with you today an endeavor I took upon myself for the first time this past week, shutting down the presentation of a fascist Nazi sympathizer right here in Richmond. myself and other members of the Virginia Anarchist Federation were recently notified that David Irving would be coming through town on Saturday to give a speech in which he would claim, among other things, that there were no gas chambers used in the Holocaust and that Hitler didn't really know anything about the mass exterminations of communists, anarchists, Jews, and homosexuals, among others. Yes, this guy is a gem.
I think the Jews have to ask themselves the question, right, is it that every time they've arrived as pitiful refugees in a country, after a few years, they have to move on? They don't seem to ask themselves that question. I know that I'm disliked as an historian. I know that I'm hated by some people. And I know the reason why, and I know what I could do to change it, instantly change my opinions. I'm not going to do it. They don't ask themselves what they could do to change the way that they are disliked.
This guy was coming to our city, and I was elected almost by default to be the guy who tried to pull the rug out from under him. Step one was to find out where he was going to be appearing. This required contacting Irving personally via email, an email which he personally responded to. It read, "Thank you for your response. Nice to hear from you. Times have been very tough since my imprisonment by Austria. I have posted on the website a working list of actual dates, and I will email the precise time and place to you a few days before the event." I had succeeded in discovering the location of his speech, but somehow I was utterly conflicted. He'd booked a private room in a Richmond restaurant that will go unnamed, and would be speaking to a crowd of people who already supported his views. Is it a matter of free speech to lie? Here was a man who has recently spent a year in Austrian prison for minimizing the Holocaust, which is a crime in that country. And I wasn't entirely sure I was in favor of that ruling. Free speech is a great value of mine. If it was free speech, did the restaurant have the right to know who they were hosting, a right to say what views could and could not be spread on their own property? And something felt wrong about this sneaky approach. I felt like a cop or a snitch, both of whom turned my stomach in most cases. After deliberation and conference with friends, I decided to put my reservations aside and at least let the restaurant know what was up. If I could prevent one person from taking in some Hitler-sympathizing neo-Nazi bullshit, I knew I would feel better about myself. After some brief discussion with the gentleman answering the phones at the restaurant where he'd be hosted, I was transferred to someone who had the power to cancel the talk.
Yeah, actually, we've got two functions. I'll tell you what, I'm going to put you on with the owner here. One moment.
Okay.
This is Darren. How can I help you?
I told Darren about who he was hosting, and he checked his schedule for Saturday night.
Book tour, okay. Book tour, 20 people, yes.
As I suspected, he hadn't quite been informed of who would be there.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly didn't know. All that they reserved it as was a historical book tour.
I suspected this because Irving's first U.S. appearance since his release from prison was booked without the full knowledge of his venue, which happened to be a Catholic church earlier this month. Needless to say, when the clergy found out halfway through the talk who was holding a semi-secret meeting in their basement, they were none too pleased.
Someone made a reservation to have a discussion of a book. The name was not David Irving. We knew nothing about it. We thought it would be just something nice for the community, and it turns out that it was David Irving. We were completely deceived, and really we're outraged because we do not cater to that kind of bigotry, and I'm really sorry that this happened.
And when Irving's audience heard that the police would be coming soon, possibly to eject them all, they were none too pleased, and David Irving's manager urged fierce resistance from the crowd.
The detectives are going to be here, the police in the past, and you resist.
So what did the Richmond restaurant have to say about this?
I'm not sure what to do or say. The only thing I can think of is because they took a private room, so the only thing I can think of, as long as they don't cause disturbance, I mean, I hope there's no disturbances here.
So that was it. As long as the audience didn't start randomly rioting, Irving would be able to have his talk without the slightest glitch. There was nothing I could really do about that, so I decided to find someone who might be interested in showing up at the event to argue counterpoints to Irving's arguments, so at the very least he wouldn't go unchallenged. But who to ask? How about a Jew?
Shalom, JCCM Federation. This is Lane.
Yes, the Weinstein Jewish Community Center on Monument Avenue. Now all I had to do was reach someone who could help me.
I think that you should speak to somebody in the Federation. So I'm going to transfer you to Ellen Moncure, who works in the Jewish Community Federation.
Okay.
Hang on for a minute. Okay, you know what? I just heard she's not in today. I'm going to transfer you to Larry Rosen.
Okay.
Hang on for a minute.
But unfortunately...
Hello, this is Larry Rosen at the Jewish Community Federation of Richmond. Sorry I can't take your call right now. Please leave me a message and I will return your call.
So I got back to the receptionist.
Let's try Sarah Rosenbaum. Hang on for a minute.
Okay.
But unfortunately...
Hello, you've reached Sarah Rosenbaum at the Jewish Community Federation of Richmond. Please leave a message and I will return your call as soon as possible. Thank you.
So I got back to the receptionist.
Let's try somebody else. I'm going to transfer you to Diane Munsey.
Hello, this is Diane.
Success, someone on the phone. But unfortunately...
Do you have something you could email to someone? Because I'm really not the one to be talking to.
And round we go.
Hi, this is Allison Lancaster, and you've reached the Weinstein JCC. If you could please leave me a message, I will get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you.
Maybe the director will be in.
Hello. You have reached Scott Katz, Assistant Executive Director. I am unable to answer the phone at the present time. If you would leave your name, number, and a complete message, I will get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you very much, and have a nice day.
I tried to explain to the first secretary that all I really needed was someone with working knowledge of the Holocaust and World War II to attend a function on Saturday.
You're going to run into issues with it still being light out, and since it's Saturday, we're still in the Jewish Sabbath, so any religious people who would be interested wouldn't be able to do it because it's before sundown, because our day of rest is from tonight at sundown till tomorrow night at sundown.
I was a little confused about why God would object to the defense of his chosen people, or any good work really, on the Sabbath, but I had to accept that as a staunch atheist I just wouldn't be able to understand. She did, however, have a suggestion about who I could contact.
I would start with the Holocaust Museum. And Jay Ipsen is the director, and he is a survivor.
Virginia Holocaust Museum, how may I help you?
Finally, in Jay Ipsen, the director of the Holocaust Museum, I'd found someone who had the knowledge necessary to oppose Irving's dangerous message. And Ipsen knew exactly who I was talking about, knew him well enough that he refused to even justify his message by showing up. He did, however, grant me an interview about the situation.
Well, I was rather surprised that David Irving would come to Richmond. I thought Richmond was above that kind of individual to give him any kind of space or time or for any individuals to listen to the lies that he has to tell about the Holocaust. I guess that's the reason the museum is here, is to teach people more acceptance and at least enlighten them on some of the facts. Well, David Irving actually went out and said that Hitler knew nothing about the Holocaust until 1943, which is a total lie. He started it many years before that. David Irving also sued Dr. Deborah Lipstadt, who was a scholar and wrote a book for Penguin Books. She called him a Holocaust denier and gave the facts. He was able to bring a case against her in Judge Charles Gray's court, courtroom 37 in London, that she defamed his character. Ultimately, he lost the case, and it cost him, or it should have cost him, $2 million sterling. But he could not come up with it, so he went bankrupt. He had 400 followers that helped bankroll him during the court trial. Unfortunately, 200 of them were from the United States. So you can see what we're dealing with.
I took the time to explain to Ipsen my concerns about Irving's free speech, regardless of how much I didn't like what he had to say, and to ask his own opinion on the matter.
Free speech is one of the most powerful tools that we have. But it needs to be honest free speech, not lies. The moment you lie and people believe what they hear, you are causing subversion and you're causing problems and you're causing pain. To take an innocent person and label him as a guilty criminal is wrong. That's not free speech, that's hate speech. You should be able to write any factual data. Now, in other countries in Europe, You can't do that. You cannot write facts about the government under free speech, because they give you no free speech. You write something about the government, you end up in jail. Or worse yet, they do away with you. You go to sleep one night, you never wake up the next morning. Everybody knows that the Holocaust happened. There's proof all over the place. You come to the Virginia Holocaust Museum and you'll see it on the walls. You'll see my picture and mine to be deported for execution. It's no lie. It's me. But when you deny that, that's not right. And when he went and again made speeches denying the Holocaust and coming up with lies, then the government put him in jail for it. It's illegal to lie. Like you take Mr. Irwin denied that there was an extermination camp known as Auschwitz I. He said it was built after 1948 as a tourist business attraction kind of thing to bring visitors to Poland. There were 1,600 death camps in Europe, 10,000 concentration camps, and there are records of all of them in the American archives. They were presented during the Nuremberg trials and proven.
Ibsen welcomes the listeners of this show to visit the Richmond Holocaust Museum and see these evidences for themselves. As for me, despite my own efforts, David Irving spoke in Richmond this past Saturday. My conscience is clear, as I did all I could to prevent the event from taking place, short of violence. But I hope the fact that it was so close to home reminds the listeners of this show that fascism is a long way from dead. Sometimes it's not in so obvious a package as David Irving, but it exists all around us. I hope that we'll be vigilant against events like this in the future and rid our city of the ideologies of fear, hate, racism, and empire. Got one more segment for today's show, and its subject truly fits my opening description of alternative lifestyles.
My name's Keegan the Vegan, that's what I go by. Vegan straight edge, have been for 11 years, and I'm the vocalist and guitarist behind True Nature, which is a music project based around raising awareness for animal liberation, earth liberation, and human liberation.
Keegan told me how the values of veganism and straight edge affected him from an early age.
When I was about 11 years old, I started listening to a band called Earth Crisis. And they're a vegan straight edge hardcore band from the mid-90s. And it was just, their lyrics were really profound to me. They talked about how animals are really treated in industrial factory farms and in laboratories around the world and the horrific conditions that they live through. And because of that, I realized that I was supporting those industries. So I made a choice when I was 12 years old to no longer be part of that, so I adopted a vegan lifestyle, which wasn't a huge shift for me, to be honest. It's a pretty easy lifestyle to adapt to.
Right.
And veganism is, you know, living without the use of any animal products. That includes, you know, all meat, dairy, eggs, honey, and then also animal fibers like silk or wool. Animal products have a way of working their way into virtually everything. I mean, from house paint to glue to soaps. And, you know, it's really trying to minimize as much as you can the support of those industries, just because these animals suffer, you know, tremendous deal. So, yeah, I mean, it really comes down to how far you're willing to take it, but the main thing to really focus in on, because it's the largest industry, is the food aspect of it. I mean, there's some vegans who, yeah, don't have a problem wearing silk, or who eat honey, just because they feel that insects, it's not a, you know, an ethical concern. For me personally, it's wanting to live as much as I can independent from those industries.
Just
Straight Edge. Started in the 80s, and Straight Edge represents a lifestyle commitment to sobriety, so no drugs, alcohol, or tobacco. And usually, and in my opinion, abstaining from promiscuous sex.
This would mean essentially sex that is outside of a significant other type relationship, like a pair bonding type relationship?
Yeah, or just, I mean, sex with love, you know, it's just so that there's an open communication between partners so that there can be a mutual respect.
Let's talk about radical sobriety. Why a constant state of sobriety? Why is there not a time where you feel like you can kind of let yourself kind of, you know, have a few beers and enjoy the evening type thing?
For me personally, it's basically the same values for veganism. I look at the alcohol industry in particular, and you know, the 24,000 people who die every year from alcohol-related accidents. I mean, there's upwards of 60,000 people who die from alcohol-related diseases, and I see an industry who's profiting from suffering. You know, for every kid who's been beaten by their alcoholic father, like, you know, I've made a commitment to say that I'll never be an abuser. I mean, for every, you know, and that's just alcohol. And tobacco, we're talking about 440,000 people killed every year, and Philip Morris is profiting from that. And though these are voluntary choices, it's the choices that people made, not necessarily in the best, you know, times, and then they, you know, it's basically enslavement, and they don't really have a choice after a while. These addictions are so strong and, you know, so destructive that I feel that, you know, part of my standing in solidarity with those who have, you know, suffered from these industries, to say that, you know, I won't have any part of it. You complain about the government and everything they say, but don't you realize with your eyes a bush and fill up once you're buying them. Go to school, go to work, go to sleep, pay around. Don't you see you're turning out like your parents? Go to college, get a job and buy a house and drive a car. If you're lucky, take your revolution dictions along. Have your life with all the grills, pay your taxes, pay your bills yourself. Keep around to the grave. Buy the shit that you don't need, plant the corporate seed. Can't you see? Keeping yourself enslaved. Well, I don't wanna be.
That's all we got time for today. We want to thank you for listening to Weekly Sedition, and thank you for listening to 97.3 WRIR. It's Richmond Independent Radio, radio for the rest of us.